The nonprofit MBA purpose is to provide new business insight. The nonprofit MBA purpose is to provide new business insights and fresh creative ideas for executive directors and their teams that will help them improve their organization. Here is your host, Stephen Halasnik.
Hello, everyone. My name is Stephen Halasnik. I will be your host for today's nonprofit MBA podcast, as I have been for the past 6 years. I am the co-founder, for those of you who don't know me, of Financing Solutions. And Financing Solutions for the last 13 years has been the number one leading provider, largest provider of lines of credit for small nonprofits in the United States. It's a very, very popular product. Lines of credit are extremely hard for nonprofits to get, and that's exactly what we do. So we're really good at it. It's a great product for uneven cash flow. If you're interested in learning more about our line of credit, please visit nonprofitmbapodcast.com. And today I'm very excited to be speaking with Lizia. Did I pronounce it correct?
No, it's Lizia Pena.
Lizia Pena. I'm sorry.
I wrote it down.
I pronounced it correct twice. And of course, right on air, I do it wrong. And her organization is Globetrotting Fundraiser. She is the international legacy expert, consultant, and speaker for over 22 years, and she has all her experience in the nonprofit sector. Her company, Globetrotting Fundraiser, serves small, medium, and large international organizations around the globe. She's also currently working on her PhD dissertation at the University of Kent, researching national legacy marketing campaigns. So, Lizia, welcome to today's nonprofit MBA podcast.
It's my pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
Sure. So, just to get everybody off on the right foot here, when we're talking about legacy programs, what are we talking about here?
Very specifically, we're talking about what in North America we call planned giving. So all deferred donations, such as gifts and wills, gifts of life insurance, annuities, stocks, etc. But more specifically, what I work with clients is to focus on gifts and wills, and to a lesser degree, life insurance, mainly because the majority of all planned gives come from bequests. And so this is where we should be focusing on more than anything else.
How do you, for a nonprofit that really hasn't focused on legacy programs at all, how would you suggest they start off?
Well, first and foremost, it starts off with digging into your database. Everything fundraising related needs to be data centered. And so that means digging in your data to find out who's in your database. Are we looking at a database full of very young people, or is it a mix, or is it a lot more older donors? And then from that point forward is looking at who have been the donors that have been contributing for many, many years. Even small amounts, actually more than anything else, small amounts, but consistently for a very long time. So things like donors like your monthly donors, your donors that give once or twice a year, but in the smaller range, those are the prospects you want to be having conversations with to start exploring gifts and wills with these donors.
So let's role play a scenario here. I'm one of the bigger donors for this nonprofit. You know, I'm 60 years old. I've been giving to your organization. You're the executive director. I've been giving to your organizations for 5 years now. I give, one of the larger sums. So tell me what you would say to me to consider giving a legacy donation.
Well, first, I want to note that I mentioned donors who've been giving a long time and usually smaller amounts, and you're asking an example with someone that's a major gift donor. Now, there's a distinction between these two things. Mainly is that what we see across the board in all markets that promote gifts and wills is that it's usually the donors that give smaller amounts. So I'm talking $25 a month or $100 a year or whatever the case may be, but have been giving for many, many years. It is not, it's not necessarily the major donor that gives you $1 million last year. Okay. So it's really important to understand this because there is a very big distinction. Now, I'm not saying that major donors don't leave gifts and wills. Of course they do. But if you're starting out and you want to start with those that have a higher engagement level, it is your smaller donors, your donors that, excuse me, let me rephrase that. I didn't mean to say it's smaller donors. It's your donors that make smaller donations. But to use the example that you just shared, a donor's been giving you $5,000, $10,000, $15,000 a year, every year for consistently, then I would have, actually, that would be a very special case. That would be the kind of donor that I would explore having a blended gift. So ensuring that in my ask, I would make sure that we would renew that annual major gift, but start the conversation also to explore the possibility of integrating a gift and a will. So I would talk about how their past major gifts have impacted the mission. So whatever the case may be, let's say it's an after-school program. So I would talk about and demonstrate, and that's the key thing. It's not just about talking about impact. It's about demonstrating the impact that the donor has had with their gift over the years. And then helping them visualize what the future could look like if they were to include a gift and a will to the charity. So this is how you want to drive the conversation, because it's not about, unfortunately, there's still that misconception that talking about gifts and wills is about death. Actually, quite the contrary. It's about talking, it's about talking about the life that the person has lived, what their values are, and how those values connect to the mission of the organization. So it's a very rich level of conversation that you're having with your donors. And that's why knowing your donors, and I'm going to harp on this, but going back to your database and looking at beyond just the numbers, beyond just the how many gifts they've made and how many donations have come in through their giving over the years, is you also want to know the person as who they are, what's important to them, and what makes them tick, so that you can make those connections for the donor.
Yeah, I guess that means too, although it is hard at a $25 donation to look at their database. And if you haven't really met with that person much, I mean, I know you can look at the numbers from, some services and stuff like that, but if you have a lot of people giving $25 donations, right, it's hard to really get to know them, take, it's the larger donations that you tend to get to know those people really well. Is that fair to say?
No, I do. I completely disagree, actually.
Oh, okay.
If you're not taking the time to know all your donors, and as well as those $25 a month donors, then there's something, you're doing something wrong in your fundraising, because that is your pipeline, both for your mid-level giving and your plan giving program. And so you can get to know those $25 a month donors through brand surveys, through the satisfaction surveys. You can do some prospecting with a legacy specific survey. You can have telemarketing campaigns. There's a million ways you can engage with those donors. You can invite them to various donor recognition events. And then this is why it's important. Again, it's about digging in your database and doing some propensity modeling to see who is coming up to the surface that you should be starting to have a conversation. So if you're not tracking their date of birth, for instance, if you're not tracking their marital status, then all you have is the donation amount, which is just one facet of a person. And so, no, and actually, if all you're going to do is focus on your major donors, you're leaving most of the money on the table and you're going to miss out. So I would want to have someone that just focuses on major gift donors, because that's a very narrow way of looking at your database. And that's why organizations are not raising as much money as they could. I mean, in the US, when you look at it, only 9% of all philanthropic giving comes from planned giving. There's something wrong. That's embarrassing. And I'm not saying this to be outrageous. You should be raising so much more. The breadth and depth of the philanthropic market in the US is so colossal. It just blows my mind that number is not higher than 25% 25%. In the UK, about 17 or 18% of all gifts and philanthropic giving comes from gifts and wills, and it's a teeny tiny market. But they do it in a way that is absolutely fantastic.
Is there? That's good information. Thank you for sharing that. I get it with the surveys and everything. That's great. Is there? If you are starting off for the first time, really looking and saying, you know, listening to this podcast, you're saying, you know, we need to do this better. You want to start off small so that you can learn, get your verbiage down, all this. Is there a targeted range for age that you think makes more sense to start going at, this whole idea?
Yeah, you want to go basically from older and moving your way backwards, right? So if you're just starting out and you don't know where to start, you would want to look at your database and identify those donors that are 65 years and older. So you would start engaging with them. And so something that one of my good friends, Jen Love, who is outside of Toronto at Agents of Good, she says, sprinkle that legacy dust. So start sprinkling legacy related messaging across all your communication channels. So basically not starting a new brochure, you don't need to do that right away, but use the communications that your donors are used to seeing and reading on a regular basis, and take up a little bit of that real estate to start talking about demystifying gifts and wills. And when I say demystifying, it's not talking about tax advantages, because that's probably the number one reason, the number one mistake that charities do is they talk about the tax advantages. Well, I don't know about you, but I don't give to a charity for the tax advantages.
No.
It's been proven, and it's, you know, not just me, it's been proven time and time again. Talk about the impact, show the measurable impact that your organization's having thanks to the donations. Help the donor understand how their legacy, their gift and will, and the legacy they can leave behind for the organization can have significant impact in the future. And then you look at your donors over 65, and then you start talking to them. You send them a survey to gauge a little bit where their thought process is around the subject of gifts and wills. I mean, on my website, I have a sample survey that people can download. There's tons of resources there as well. And so just starting that conversation with your donor 65 and over is fantastic. Then you can start looking at donors between 40 and 65. And the reason why this is important right here, right now, at this point in time, is because Gen Xers, so people basically in my age group, we're probably already doing our first will or in the process of updating our will. And what you want to do is be in that first will, because then if you engage with them and you keep them interested, the organization won't get thrown out of the will. So it's important to have this two-prong approach of developing relationships with the older donors, but also looking at how you can engage the younger. And when I say younger is 40 and over, which is not super young, but it's not old either. So you want to have this two-prong approach, because the way baby boomers engage with charities is extremely different than how Gen Xers engage with charities. So you want to think of it in that way.
Organizations that are the benchmark in getting legacy giving, and you can even use, you know, the example that you said that England is double the legacy giving rate that the United States is. What are those organizations that are leaderships in this category? What do they do really well that the ones who aren't good at it don't?
I would say they're very good. The ones that I think of, they're very good at the word I'm looking for is communicating what gifts and wills, how to do gifts and wills, and the power that gifts and wills have in a way that is not filled with fundraising or legal jargon, that is understandable for the common person. So when you think about it, you know, anyone that reads grade six level would be able to understand, right? And that's what you want to be doing, because the organizations that fail miserably is because they talk about the, either the tax advantages or the legal side of things. And the thing is that most people, most of us, we don't have a degree in a law degree or a certificate in financial planning. And so the best way to turn donors off is to talk about all that, because and it's normal human behavior to, you know, anything we don't understand or makes us feel dumb, we'll just resist it, right? What you resist persists. Well, that's a great way to create a wall between what you're trying to do and your donor is by talking about the legal or the financial advantages. So those organizations that do really well are able to communicate that kind of information in very enticing, interesting ways. And they also look at engaging with donors both online and offline. And that's really important, because that's something as well. I just got back from AFP Icon, and as well as another conference in plan giving. And it was mind-boggling how there's still a very old traditional way of marketing plan giving, in that it's still, you know, the face-to-face, which is great. You still need to do that. But it's still very much offline. And we need to be exploring more the online side of legacy giving. So that's what I would say. The organizations that do well know how to do that.
Let's make sure we're clear here too. There's no financial advantages to making a donation to a charity. That's the word advantages, financial advantages, that there is none. So let's be clear. When you give, like say you give $1,000 to a charity, you don't get $1,000 back on your taxes, all right? You get 30% of that money. You're paying less taxes depending on your tax bracket. So you might as well take that out of your vocabulary. Financial advantages. There is no financial advantages. Now, is there a purpose and an advantages when it comes to how I feel about myself now? You know, the thing that crosses my attention, now that I'm getting a little bit older, is like, I sure as heck would like to feel good now while I'm alive about what I've done, knowing that when I die, that's going to go to places I want to go. And it's better for me to know that I would like to know it now instead of I'm dead and then I don't really, then it's not really
special. Care.
So I think it, you know, it makes a lot of sense, especially for people who are starting to get over 60, 65. You know, for those of you who are much younger, you don't know this, but you start thinking a lot about this stuff. And because you become more retired and you have more time on your hands and you have built up wealth, and you are starting to think more about these things, you know, like, you know, what was my life about? What was the purpose? You know, if I know it's going to go to this charity that I've always cared about, it makes me feel pretty good now. You know, it makes me feel fulfilled. So I think there's a lot of great reasons to start to introduce it. I know if I've never been an executive director, I've been on boards. But what I would do is start small, and, you know, start making part of my week that I will talk to X amount of people every week. I'll do the surveys. That's a good start. Do the surveys as you're talking about. That's a great way to build up your database and to start, you know, looking at people and starting getting my pitch down, my process down, regardless if you delegate it, you don't delegate it. And, you know, my guess is England probably has had talks about legacy gifting more often than the United States. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, quite possibly. I think there's, I think another issue, I think in North America, and I'm going to include Canada, being Canadian, to a certain degree, is also another problem is that, so when we say planned giving, like we said at the beginning of the podcast, it includes a lot of different financial vehicles as well. And my and this is not, this is, I think, and this is an opinion, it's not based on any evidence at all, but this is based also on 22 years of experience of doing this, of my observations in the sector and talking to people, you know, north, south, east, west of North America. I see the problem is that a lot of the smaller organizations tend to look at the big institutions that have traditionally been doing running planned giving programs for decades. I'm talking about the large educational institutions, hospital foundations, cultural institutions, those kinds of things. And so they've got these, they have their planned giving program canned. Like they've been doing it, it's a machine. It keeps, you know, churning donors and they're raising a lot of money, building huge endowments. And so small organizations that don't have the resources or, and I'm not saying just small organizations, like organizations that don't have massive resources like those institutions, look at them and go, well, that's what we need to emulate in order to do, be in the game. And the problem is that hinders them more than anything else because they're not thinking that perhaps like, hey, maybe you don't have the kind of donors that big university X or big ballet company Y has. And so why would you want to build your program to emulate that, to, you know, build it according to that structure, because your structure is completely different. Maybe you don't have donors that have these very complex financial structures, and therefore they don't need to have, they don't need to be marketed for annuities and IRAs and whatever, all other financial products. Keep it super simple. Keep it simple. Keep it to gifts and wills. Life insurance is also super simple to do. You can offer that for your younger donors that they can buy a life insurance and donate it to your charity. It's a very easy way of leaving a legacy. And then should you ever have a donor ask you for something more advanced that is beyond your knowledge base, that's when you go get those allied professionals to help you and to coach you and to mentor you and to also have that conversation with your donors. So I think this is what hinders the market quite a lot is that, oh, well, so-and-so is doing it. We need to do it exactly like that. No, you don't. Keep it super simple. Always keep it super simple. To what you're saying about starting that conversation, I love the idea of like call one or two donors every week that you see have has the potential. I'll give you an example. When I was frontline fundraising, I was a sole fundraiser in a small school for kids with hearing loss. I was the only person in the foundation, ran the whole thing. I did everything from writing the appeal to building a legacy program. And the way we didn't have the time or the energy or the money to start a program, but I wanted to start building at least my pipeline of prospects. And so I called every single donor for every single donation, every time a donation came in, regardless of the amount. Whether it was $5 or $15,000, I always called to say thank you. And that was it. There was no additional ask. There was nothing else. It was only thank you. Many donors, I was surprised that they would say, you're the only charity that calls to say thank you. And I donate to a lot of charities. So boom, one gold star for our charity. But it also helped me build that pipeline of prospects, because if they were picking up the phone on Wednesday afternoon at 2 p.m., and you know that someone that's older, their voice, you could hear it in their voice, I knew that they could potentially be a legacy prospect in the future. So I would just market prospect in my CRM. And so then when we were ready to launch the program, at least I had something to do. So at least I had a list to start with. So those are like simple free things you could be doing, which goes back to the initial comment of, yeah, you can get to know your donors, but you need to put that as a priority in your operations to engage with your donors.
Yeah, I think like I often think about smaller nonprofits, because that's who we work with. That's who we interact with, you know, organizations that are $5 million and less in revenue a year. And I think one of the things that I would do too is when my nonprofit's having fundraising events, and I get to meet the people who are maybe whoever it is, it could be a bigger donor, it could be a smaller donor. And let's say I want to start a legacy program. I might look for somebody and one of my donors who is, who's got, you know, a dynamic personality, who has time on their hands, and talk to them and say, listen, I'd like to start launching this legacy program. You know, it might require a couple of hours a week. You know, do you think you can start to learn about it and start to approach and people who might be good fits? Because I know my hunch is a couple of things based on our clients that I see. A lot of nonprofits are worried about this year and next year. And so Looking 10 years down the line, 15 years down the line, they're like, you know, I got to be worried about us next year, not, you know, 15 years down the line. And so it, you know, keeps getting pushed back. And we all know that executive directors at smaller nonprofits are running around with their head cut off, right? They just so many different things that they have to do. So, you know, that comes into play where, you know, you sit there and say, you know, is there a way I can delegate this without having to hire somebody that's going to be responsible for this? Because if you talk about, even probably the first person they would hire is someone who's in charge of fundraising in general, instead of, you know, someone who's dedicated to legacy. So that might be an avenue for them to get the program going. Even if they did the legwork and learned about legacy program, put something together, put a process together, and, you know, set up appointments for the executive director to go out and talk to people based on the data, you know, that would keep the focus on it too. Sounds cool.
Yeah. And I mean, again, like I actually wrote a chapter in a book on small shop fundraising. So I totally know where you're coming from. Absolutely. Because like I've done this with, when I was at Greenpeace International, I started a passive legacy program. And what that meant was, let's put information, sprinkle that legacy dust everywhere, and start normalizing the conversation about legacy. So, because we know that, you know, like traditionally in business, we would say many years ago, someone has to hear a message 7 times for that message to be registered. Well, now with the influx of everything, we're overwhelmed with information. We need to hear a message at least 22 times before anyone registers. So if you're in a small shop, you're 1 or 2 people shop, or you're the sole fundraiser in an organization, you can start just doing that by putting little stuff in your newsletter, put it in your PS of your appeals, put it in your email signature, all of the things in which you could just nudge, always be in this stage of nudging, right? And eventually when you do have the resources, whether it be a hired person or you hire someone externally to help you build that strategy to have a forward, like a proactive program, then at least that it doesn't become it's not a surprise to your donors. And so putting in place a structure for that is relatively simple. And sometimes all you need is just a few little tips here and there about your CRM and what you could be doing. But at the end of the day, is every time you have any sort of interaction with your donors, you need to be always thinking, could this be a prospect? What questions can I ask so I can get to know them better? And then making sure that you actually input the information in your CRM in a way that it could be searchable and you can do a query over it. So you want to do all these things. I wanted to circle back to something you were saying before, and I missed it before. Yes, while you do want to look at your older donors over 65, but don't forget that also the donors who are younger in the Gen X, as I was saying earlier, whether they're writing their first will or updating, they're going through life changes, major life changes, whether that be getting married, buying a house, having kids. So they're also having those reflective conversations or having those reflections of, well, I need to take care of my business. I got to get my house in order so that should something happen, everything is taken care of. So you don't need to wait to be retired or anything of the sort to be having that thought process, because while someone older, the thought process is a little bit different. Someone in the 40 to 55, 60 age range, they're looking at, okay, well, how can I make sure that my loved ones are taken care of should something happen to me and my kids need to be, looked after? So you want to, don't discard the younger one, the younger donors in your database.
Yeah. The only thing I would just counsel someone who's an outsider is I would be careful about using the word legacy without without explaining it. Because a layman may not understand that concept of, oh, legacy equals giving money in my will,
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. And the research demonstrates that. So Dr. Russell James out of Texas Tech University actually did that research about it, which was relating to the titles that fundraisers have, plan giving officer, director, da-da, legacy, et cetera. And basically, it means absolutely nothing to donors. So if you want to talk to a donor about a gift in a will, talk about a gift in a will. Don't talk about bequest. That's legal language. Gift in a will, simple. People can understand that. You want to talk about a gift in of life insurance, talk about the gift in life insurance. Legacy is just the overall catch-all name, which is still not inappropriate, but means nothing. I mean, it's internal lingo. Just like plan giving is, it's internal lingo. Nobody gets it. I can tell you, a lot of fundraisers also don't know what is legacy and what is plan giving. You'd be surprised, because if they're not working in that area, they don't quite really know what that means, right? So use specific, simple language.
Yeah, I have another question that came to my mind, and then we got to wrap it up. But do you, when someone says yes, I agree with you, I think I would like to make a donation in my will to the organization. I'll say it in very abrupt terms. How do you prove it? Someone could say that and you don't know. How do you handle that end?
So, of course, there's, your thank you and celebration, and you want to be creative about how you can recognize your donors. That's the beauty, but also the downfall of gifts and wills is that they can say that, but you'll only get 100% proof when the person passes away, because they may put you in the will and you can ask for a copy of, at least the page or the section of the will. But that doesn't mean anything at the end of the day, because they could turn around and change the will 3 months later and not notify you, and you're none the wiser. You can also, what I do is, because a lot of donors are reluctant to share a copy of their will or at least the page with the clause, which is fine, because it's a personal, it's the absolute most personal document anyone will ever draft. What you could do is also have a gift announcement form. That basically, and I've created one, a template that's also on my website that people can download. It basically puts the power in the donor's hands. Basically, let us celebrate you, but you keep control of it. So if you want, please let us know what kind of gift it is. Who is your next of kin? Who do you want us to thank? How do you want to be thanked? Who will be the executor and how may we get in touch with them? And then give them an opportunity to provide like a message for future generations that relates to their gift. And so that gives the donor that opportunity to be full control of their gift. But of course, at the end of the day, you have to take their word for it. They may not want to complete that form. They may not want to give you a page of the will. You still have to, you can take their word for it and hope that it actually comes through.
Yeah. The good news about that form that you're talking about is if I was the executor of my mom's passing or my dad's passing and you sent me a note, I'm sorry about your mom passing. Mm-hmm. I just want to make you aware this is a form that she filled out for us about a legacy. Like I know my wife who passed, she really likes St. Jude's a lot, right? Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. I contribute regularly to St. Jude's because of her. And so, as the executor of the estate, even if she didn't have it in the will, right, then I would have followed through on it. And, and that's mm-hmm. actually a good thing to do for any type of person you think, without even having them have to add it to the will. So I'm sure you're going to, you talk to them about that, but I can't see many. Only for estates that are very small, where the family needs the money, which is a lot of people, But if it's not an obscene amount of money that someone said that they want to give, then I'm sure they're going to do something. So
It would still need to be in the will, though. You can't expect a donation just because they completed that form if at the end of the day it was not actually in the will. The executor has no obligation to follow that. But it has happened where I've heard of cases where the executor was given basically carte blanche to make philanthropic donations, and a charity called to convey condolences and to tell stories about the donor. And the executor was so taken by surprise and impressed with the organization that they decided to make a significant gift out of the estate to that charity in particular. So basically the moral of the story is engaging with donors and stewardship of gifts happens even after the donor has passed.
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind when my wife passed, I was looking for ways to memorialize her anyway. So, that would have been something that would have caught my attention. So that's all the time we have today. It was a very good discussion. I learned a lot. I'm sure my listeners did as well. I'd like to thank so very much. Lizia from, I know I pronounced it wrong again.
Ligia,
I apologize. Ligia Pena from Globetrotting Fundraising. And for coming on today's podcast. And if you like today's podcast, please feel free to share it with a friend and subscribe on your favorite podcasting app. We always have great guests. And if you like today's podcast, please also give us a 5-star review. It really helps us get our word out. The podcast is in the top 1% of podcasts in its space in nonprofits in the United States. And we thank you for that. And if you're looking for a line of credit for your nonprofit, please feel free to visit our website at nonprofitmbapodcast.com. If any of our listeners want to get a hold of you, how would they go about doing that?
They can go to www.globetrottingfundraiser.com. It's all one word. And there's a contact form there. And there's also the resource page where you can download without a paywall, without a email wall or anything. You can download the resources that I mentioned in the podcast, as well as a few others as well.
Thanks for coming on today.
Thank you so much for having me.
I just want to remind our guests that I'm not our guests, our listeners, that you guys are out there every single day trying to make a world a better place. And I really thank you for that. But you're not of any help to anybody, to your family, your friends, your employees, and even yourself, if you don't think about taking good care of yourself on a day by day basis. I know that that nonprofit leaders are so passionate about their cause that they often forget about themselves. And I just want to remind you that solving and helping the world is a marathon and not a sprint. And you need to be at your best every single day, every single week, every single year. And in order to do that, you need to really think about yourself first, and then you can help the rest of the world. So just keep that in mind. And we all know what that means. Taking good care of yourself could be eating right, exercising, getting up, meditating, praying, whatever it needs for you to be a whole person. So thank you for all the work that you're doing. And other than that, I want to thank you for listening to the Nonprofit MBA podcast. I'll see you guys.